You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host, and our guest today is the president and CEO of the California Wellness Foundation, leading in that role since 2014. Previously, she's held various senior positions in philanthropy over the last 30 years. She launched Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors' West Coast and Midwest offices, which helped to propel the firm into one of the nation's largest independent nonprofit advisories. Prior to her tenure at RPA, she was the vice president of global public affairs at Levi Strauss & Co., where under her leadership, it received for its fight against institutional racism the first Ron Brown Award for corporate leadership. She is also personally known for her work to create greater equity, diversity, and inclusion, as well as a champion of the rights of immigrants. She currently serves on the board of the Cerdna Foundation, and she is a writer whose work regularly appears in the Los Angeles Times, and she's a member of the board of Hedgebrook, a women's writing retreat that promotes women's voices and social change. In recognition of her writing, she was inducted into the Alexandria, Virginia, her hometown's African American Hall of Fame. And I am honored and thrilled to bring to you today my friend and colleague in mission-based work, Judy Belk. How are you today, Judy?
Oh, Art, thank you for that lovely introduction. I felt that my entire professional world, there was a huge flashback. So, and it probably just means I'm getting old. It's great to reconnect with you, an old friend. I've sat around many tables with you. I've just been impressed with your leadership heading up the Wise Giving Alliance. So I'm just honored to be sitting at a virtual table with you. I'm at my home in Hollywood, and you're in the D.C. area near my hometown of Alexandria, Virginia.
Well, yes. And speaking of hometowns, one of the first questions I like to ask my guests is how they got started in this life of service. For you, it must have been something that triggered this interest in you from your days as a young girl here in Alexandria. Tell me about that. Tell our guests a little bit about the young Judy Belk.
Oh, the young Judy Belk. Well, really, my life really started, I always say, about 10 miles from the White House. I grew up at a time in this country where, again, not dissimilar to what's happening now, that this country was tackling race. So I grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, born in a segregated hospital in Alexandria, Virginia, before it was a tourist destination. And my life in terms of what I had access to, what I didn't have access to, was determined a lot by the color of my skin. I lived for, you know, the first 10 years of my life in a small, supportive African-American neighborhood in Alexandria, but without access to water or indoor plumbing. It's pretty unbelievable when you think, because I'm old, but I'm not that old. I would say that the first significant impact on me that's reference to my journey is getting access to public education. When I started school, the Brown decision was the law of the land, but the state of Virginia always was a tough nut to crack on institutional racism, just fought it. And the city of Alexandria, that's part of their history. And so my mother, very courageous, at the age of 25, joined a group of other African American parents, raising their hands, saying that they would be test case for the Brown decision. And this is where philanthropy came in. Of course, the NAACP, the Legal Defense Fund, there were just amazing African-American attorneys. But the case was funded by the Jewish philanthropic community in Alexandria. They made it happen. As a result of that, we won the case. I had access to school because when I started out, I was going to a separate but very unequal school. That decision really changed my life. But it would take another 10 years before the city would really integrate its schools. And in fact, it was so significant that Hollywood made a movie about it. Remember the Titans,
right.
Denzel Washington. That was about T.C. Williams, the school that I was in. So that was one. I guess the other one, which is also a really important lesson for me about the impact of philanthropy. A generous philanthropist in Alexandria decided that every child should have access to the arts. And so she provided funding to a community-based organization that I was a part of to provide us the opportunity to go over to the National Theater to see professional arts. And so I remember seeing the opera Carmen for the first time. It was the first time I saw a live professional arts production. I was mesmerized. And as a result of that, I have been a lover of the arts ever since. That philanthropist, I wish I knew who she was so I could, you know, reach out to her family to thank her for giving me that opportunity. And then the final game changer for me was I was really interested in the arts and communication, and my drama teacher encouraged me to apply to some strange sounding school called Northwestern. And I almost didn't apply because I thought it was in Seattle. It's really outside of Chicago. I applied. I got in. I was the first. My parents did not go to college. And the idea that they were going to let me go to some strange school they had never heard of, that was a big discussion in my family. But when they saw the financial package, the letter which had a big zero by parental contribution, my father said, okay, yeah, I guess you can go. And this was, at least in my life, I didn't have the opportunity to visit colleges beforehand. So my parents drove me to Northwestern, dropped me off, and that too changed my life because a group of philanthropists, donors to Northwestern really felt that it was important to provide philanthropic support to someone like me. So lots of stories of where philanthropy giving has really made a huge, huge impact. And for all of those experiences, I certainly had no idea that there was even a job or an opportunity to make a living in philanthropy. But what I did get from that experience was a belief that collective action, courage by my mother, support and resources can make a difference in terms of social justice, and generosity and giving and service can make an impact in the lives of so many. It certainly made an impact in the life of a young Black girl growing up in segregated Alexandria.
That's amazing. Judy, I had no idea that your life intersected with that groundbreaking case, Brown versus the Board of Education. And to say that your life has changed in a dramatic way since you grew up would be an understatement. Here you are in Hollywood, having grown up in Alexandria without running water. I just find that to be so much the American tale.
Yeah, you know? And you know, Art, the other lesson that I learned from that, I didn't know it at the time, but place matters. I mentioned to you, I mean, you know the Washington, D.C. area. So literally, I grew up 10 miles from the White House, but my life was determined by the segregated policies 100 miles south in Richmond, Virginia. And in Alexandria in Virginia was one of the holdouts in this country's journey around racial justice. I mean, there were parts of Virginia who literally closed their public schools rather than provide access to African-American students. Now, they developed their own parallel schools for whites. I remember my parents debating whether or not they should pay the poll tax. I mean, Virginia was a real tough cookie around racial justice and racial injustice. And it was always like we were peering over the fence because we had family members who lived in the district in Washington, D.C. And their lives were very different for no other reason than place.
Wow. Well, you know, we certainly see this playing out in different ways today. And we are all, I think, very fortunate to have people like you, Judy, who grew up in some very difficult situations, now in a position to make a difference for others. And what a significant time to begin taking that on, although you've been doing it all your life. But today we see lots going on that would remind us of some of the growth that we had throughout the 60s and the 50s, as we see groups of people of all races banding together to make this country what it should be and what I think many people hoped it would be when it was founded. So you've been fortunate to be able to stand above that and earn a living by helping people to improve their lives. And I and many others would argue that we're all better for it. So the question is also now, how do we get others, especially those who work outside of the nonprofit sector, to appreciate how they can commit to causes, even if they don't do it for a living? I think it's so important for people to know that there are ways that they can contribute. We're seeing some of that in people who are marching and protesting and people who are raising their voices in different ways. But there are other more concrete ways people can do things too. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, first of all, in spite of the experiences I've had, and they obviously made a huge impression on me, I am optimistic. Believe it or not, I am optimistic about this country. I am optimistic about Americans to collectively go through this difficult time that we're going through. And it is a difficult time. And the reason is because I do believe that philanthropy and giving is part of the human DNA. I've seen some horrendous, terrible injustices during my lifetime, but I have to say, by far, I have seen more acts of generosity, more acts of giving, and more acts of service. You know, when I was not, you know, sitting here in my bedroom and was out and about traveling all over the state of California and really the country. And even when I was with Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors and advising advisors all over the world, one of the things that I would always ask taxi drivers, Uber drivers, I would ask them what were their favorite nonprofits. Or they might ask me, you know, what do you do for a living? And when I would tell them, you know, I give out other people's money for the common good and philanthropy. And they said, it sounds like a good gig. Let me tell you about one of my favorite organizations. So I have not yet met an individual who has not written a check, who has not volunteered his or her time, or who have not, you know, been even envious of the work that we get to do in organized philanthropy. As you know, when people think about philanthropists, they think about the Bill Gates, the Rockefellers, the John Andrews, and these are all amazing philanthropists. But most of philanthropy around the world is given by people maybe putting money, tithes money in, you know, in supporting their faith organizations, writing a check out to their kids' soccer team, being part of bank sales, writing $5 and $10 checks. That's the driving engine for many nonprofits, especially nonprofits in communities of color. So one of the things, one of my goals, and I know you share this with me, Art, is to really do a narrative change about what is a philanthropist. I felt so strongly about it when I was at Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors. I produced a film, and the title is I Am a Philanthropist. It's still on YouTube if people want to take a look at it. And the reason is that in my job at Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors, I advise philanthropists from all cultural backgrounds, women, folks of color. And as I started talking to them about philanthropy and philanthropists, they say, oh, Judy, I'm not a philanthropist, because that word has been hijacked. And so my goal is that if you give of your time and if you write a check, and I would say just about everybody in the world does that at some point, you're a philanthropist. We need to own that title.
Judy, it's so important that you mention everyday people and the importance that they have in making sure that our philanthropy and our culture of giving in this nation is secure. I also am troubled when I read certain statistics that indicate less people are giving today than they were 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And it was one of the reasons why we were inspired to do this podcast, because we wanted to open up people's eyes to the importance of giving in service at whatever level they find themselves. And in our country, people who give even at small levels are actually creating the independence for organizations to do the kind of work that we need done in our communities without fear of a retribution or of those who don't want to see change occur. So it's really important that people understand this, and I'm so glad you brought this up. Now, you've spent many years assisting people in their giving. Have you noticed some common mistakes, or are there things that you've advised people over the years that they could do to make their giving more impactful or more meaningful?
Art, as I mentioned, I've advised donors, you know, all over the world. So there is a real human trait in terms of giving. But as much as my family in Alexandria teases me about how difficult can it be to give away money, I think to give money away well takes some thoughtful intent. One of the questions when I'm sitting with a donor or even friends who come to me now for advice on giving, the first thing I want to know is, why do you want to give? What do you want to do? You don't have to give. So tell me what moves your soul, because I do think good giving is linked to, for organizations like Cal Wellness, to our mission and values, but to individuals. People give better and give more consistently if they're giving to something that connects with them. And it's interesting, when I talk to many donors, they've never been asked that question. They just start, you know, writing checks. I do think that whether it's your time or your money, you really ought to think about your giving, managing it as thoughtful as you might, for example, manage your investment portfolio. You might want to think about providing support, first of all, to institutions and to organizations that you personally are affiliated with. For example, in my giving, if I'm on a board, you know, when my kids were in school, if a faith organization, I'll always make sure that I'm supporting those organizations. But then, because, for example, I'm interested in women's issues, I'm always looking for the opportunity to bring what I would say new organizations in my portfolio, organizations that either others have recommended, I've done some research on. And then I think we all should have a little bit of risk in our giving portfolio. Somebody at some point had to believe in a young graduate student who had this crazy idea of taking talented young people, training them, and asking them to make a commitment to teach in underserved schools for 2 years. That was Wendy Knopf of Teach for America. Somebody had to believe in that idea before she was able to prove that it could work. Somebody had to believe in the founders who had the idea about, what if we collectively organize people to build houses for folks who have no chance of getting home ownership? Habitat for Humanity came out of that. So I would hope that everyone would think about kind of the risk portfolio. The other issue is to stick with an idea. And as they're giving, trust the nonprofit, give them general operating support, and get out of their way. So I would say good giving requires values, connection, intent, knowledge, experience, and a little bit of risk.
Excellent. That's really insightful help. And I hope people will take you up on all of those really important points. So many organizations were created because people were willing to take a chance. And I think sometimes we believe that nonprofit organizations were always with us. And that somehow, you know, there was no risk associated with starting them, and that people were just doing something that they knew would work. But so many of these organizations were created out of need, for sure. But certainly there was no indication that they were going to be successful when they began. And it took some courage on the part of people sharing what they had to make it work.
Yeah, and it took also courage and risk-taking on the part of donors to believe in.
Absolutely. The California Wellness Foundation is what's known as a health conversion foundation. What is that? What is a health conversion foundation? And is it the same as a private foundation? Is it different? Is it like a community foundation? Is it something else? What are we talking about?
That's a really good question, because it's really important when people look at foundations to really think about, well, how did they come into being? Because often it impacts the values of their giving, where they give. Cal Wellness, we are a private foundation. We're not funded by an individual, such as, you know, the Gates Foundation or the Rockefeller Foundation or the Cerdna Foundation, which were created by the generosity of a bequest by a donor. A health conversion foundation, and it's really important for people to understand it because there is a flurry of health conversion foundations. We're pretty young in terms of a foundation. We're only 27 years ago. And about 27 years ago, HealthNet, which people know today as an insurance company, was a nonprofit. They decided they wanted to raise capital and move to be a for-profit. And so in most states, when a nonprofit entity chooses to convert to become a for-profit entity, the assets of that nonprofit must be set aside for a charitable purpose. And the reason is that there were benefits that HealthNet gained, significant financial benefits they gained as a nonprofit. And the state of California says, that's great that you want to be a for-profit, but those financial benefits belong to the people of California. So the profits of HealthNet were put into a foundation. And after a lot of legal going back and forth, we opened our doors after about 2 years with about $800 million in assets. And our charter was that we are to serve the people of California in promoting health and wellness. Now there are hundreds of small and not so small health conversion foundations, because as the health industry has consolidated, for example, if a for-profit hospital comes in and buys a nonprofit hospital, the health conversion law comes in and again, a charitable entity is created. At the time, Cal Wellness was the largest health conversion foundation in the state of California until 2 years later when Blue Cross, also a nonprofit, decided to move to a for-profit. And out of that conversion came the California Endowment and the California Healthcare Foundation.
Amazing. So do all of your resources come from the conversion? Are you doing other things for people who might want to participate along with you? Or is it simply the resources that you currently have that you're distributing?
We currently, which is a whole nother topic, believe it or not, we currently, our assets, our endowment is about $1 billion. We give out between 40 to 47 million a year. I just asked my board for an additional $10 million to give out. So we are a grant-making organization. We're different from a community foundation, which receives gifts from, I mean, because really community foundations are public charities, as you know.
Yes.
They receive gifts from a variety of different donors. What makes a private foundation a private foundation is that you receive a gift from one single entity. In our case, it was because of the conversion. And part of my job is managing our endowment to ensure, in our case, we want to give out as much money as we can, but also want to be around to continue to give out money for future generations.
What are some of the key initiatives that you're undertaking today at the Calwell Foundation?
At our heart, California Wellness views ourselves we view ourselves as a public health foundation, which is why you could probably understand what my life is these days, managing a public health foundation in the state of California in the middle of a global pandemic. Our North Star is the social determinants of health, which is just a fancy way of saying where one lives. Remember that issue about place that I talked to you about? Place matters in California. But the other social determinants, the other determinants to determine if you're going to be healthy or well in this country, it's place, your income level, your education level, and the most dominant predictor of your health and wellness is still race. So that's our North Star. We're research-based. There are a couple of things that we are known for. Probably the thing that we're known for, the area we're known for the most, is violence prevention. And people sometimes look at us kind of strange. Well, what is a health foundation doing mucking around in violence prevention? But about 20 years ago, my predecessor, Gary Yates, was intrigued by research that was that came out of Harvard, which basically says that violence prevention should be viewed as a public health issue. Now, pretty much everyone today agrees with that. But back then, whoa, that was pretty revolutionary. People really viewed violence as something that you would look at as a criminal justice issue. But violence is a public health issue. And if you tie into all of the research around the impact on violence in communities, the impact of trauma, especially around young folks, and what makes it a public health issue is that it can be prevented. So we are viewed as a leader in that arena. We're one of the largest funders in the country around violence prevention, including gun violence prevention. So that's one of our major signature areas that we've tracked, that we've supported. We've been instrumental, for example, in California having one of the only public supported institutions on firearms research since our CDC is prohibited and restricted from doing much work in that area. The other issue, which is our bread and butter, is we believe it's a human right for every American, every Californian, to have access to health care. And we believe it shouldn't matter what your immigration status is, where you live or whatever, everyone should have access to health care. So we have been a proud partner with other health care funders and the state of California in really showing how effectively the Affordable Care Act can be a game changer. But even the Affordable Care Act does not provide health care to undocumented members of the state. And so we've been working in that arena also, but that's really critical to us. We also believe in advocacy. So we fund many advocacy organizations working around violence prevention, working in healthcare, working around racial and social justice. Because as you know, even though you know, we have trillions of dollars to give out in philanthropy, it pales to what government has to impact the health and wellness of Americans. And I would say the one issue that I've been driving since I've come to Cal Wellness is looking at all the assets we have at the foundation. And while most foundations, private foundations, are required to give out at least 5% on an annual basis of their endowment, I believe that we need to be more attentive to making sure that the rest of that 95% of our endowment is working for the health and wellness of Californians. So we have been using money from our endowment to make loans to nonprofits. We also think it's important about who manages our endowment. So we have been pushing to have more diverse investment managers as part of our team.
That's awesome. I think that is so important. And it's an important aspect because people miss the value that just how they do their work can have an impact on creating change in society. So it's so great to hear that you're looking not only at your grants, but how you manage your portfolio and how you do your work. That's wonderful to hear. I would suspect that the pandemic is having some significant impact on what you do as well. How has COVID-19 maybe had you shift in any way the work that you're doing to emphasize the challenges that we're seeing?
COVID-19 has changed so much art in both big and little ways. It has impacted me personally, professionally, as a leader. Personally, I lost a dear cousin, a first cousin, Dino, who lived in the Alexandria area. We lost him, you know, in May. It's just a shock. It happened very quickly. So that impact was felt early on. Second, I feel real responsibility for 40 members of the Cal Wellness Organization. We immediately, in March, moved to remote work. And we did it at the time that we collectively pulled together and probably got out more grants, rapid response grants. We just started pushing money out to partners and to organizations, not asking them to, you know, long proposals because these are trusted partners and we knew they were hurting. And I would say within 3 months, we got out $7 million. And you know, although we were privileged compared to many that we were serving, many of my staff members were also dealing with family members who have been impacted by COVID, dealing with young children at home, and working not under the best situations. So we all thought, I mean, really, I actually didn't even really pack up my office when we left because I thought, okay, we'll be back in 2 to 3 weeks. And here we are, where I have just announced to our organization that I will not require any our team members to come back until July of 2021. I haven't seen my board members in a room or individually since last December. That was our last board meeting. We went virtual for our March meeting. And that's been tough, but the board members have also rallied and just recently approved an additional $10 million. But all of that said, yes, we had to get our act together, but it's the community. It's the nonprofits who, you know, if we can't support our nonprofits, all we are is just an organization with a lot of money. And I am really worried about our nonprofits. Even some of the strongest nonprofits only have about 6 months of reserves. Nonprofits also employ a significant number of Californians, and they are getting hit with a triple whammy. Most people think nonprofits get most of their dollars from philanthropy, and as you know, government support and earned income, especially for organizations in the arts, are part of that mix, and they're getting hit on all sides while the demand for services increase. And so we have just sent out another round of rapid response grants. And we are also beginning to look at some major initiatives. We just joined with other funders in California, where I brought to the board the largest grant that I've ever brought to our board, a grant of $2 million to join with other foundations and the state of California to employ a army of contract tracers to go into underserved nonprofit communities. So we are doing everything that we can. And at the same time, the dichotomy, the inequities in our society are so apparent because our endowment, which is driven by Wall Street, we lost about $250 million in 2 days back in March. Our endowment now is back up to pre-COVID, which is just unheard of when you think about the suffering that's pouring in on my emails every day.
Yes, Judy, that is an amazing dichotomy. And your passion for service and for addressing some of our nation's disparities and dichotomies really comes through not only in this podcast, but in your writings. And I've had the pleasure of following some of your writing, particularly some of them that appeared in the LA Times. And you wrote back in April about the social determinants of health, which you also discussed here. In our next episode, I'd like to explore your writings a bit more to give our listeners a sense of how you write and what you write about and why you write. So I hope our listeners will join the next episode to hear about that. And in the meantime, I thank all of you for listening. This is the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll subscribe at all of the major podcast subscription services. And we'll be back here for the next episode very soon.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. Send your comments and ideas to Nona@thusmarket.com. That's Nona@thusmarket.com. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.